Hello out there. This is Bill Taylor, co-founder of Fast Company Magazine and author of the new book, Simply Brilliant. If you're listening to this conversation, that means you've ordered Simply Brilliant. Thank you so, so much. I'm excited to be sharing some ideas with Seth Godin, one of the great writers and thinkers and teachers when it comes to entrepreneurship, marketing, creativity, the best ways to work, heck, even the meaning of life. You know his books, you know his blog. I've been fortunate to know the man himself for the last 20 years. I actually met Seth before we launched Fast Company Magazine, and an interview I did with him in one of our early issues helped put the magazine on the map. So I thoroughly enjoyed catching up with him and trying to tease out some lessons and advice for all of you. I hope you enjoy our conversation, and thanks for your support. Hi, Seth. I'm so excited to be having this conversation, especially since we've been having an on and off intellectual conversation for more than 20 years. You know, I took a lot of philosophy courses in college, and there's a great English philosopher, Alfred North Whitehead, who once described the entire field of philosophy as, quote unquote, footnotes to Plato. Sometimes I feel like so much of our thinking about creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurship are, dare I say it, footnotes to Godin.
Oh,
I spent a little time crafting that. I thought you'd like. But, you know, my new book is all about how people and companies can do ordinary things in extraordinary ways, which is obviously a theme you've been teaching us about for decades. So I just want to compare notes a little bit, get a sense of what I've been thinking about, what I've been thinking about maps to what you've been thinking and teaching about, and then see where the conversation takes us. Does that sound like a plan?
Thrilling. I'm excited just to talk about the two of us for 1 second for the people we've invited into this conversation. I can state without fear of error that if there were no Bill Taylor, there would be no Seth Godin.
Oh my goodness, that's a very touching thing to say. I do recall so vividly, and I hope folks will indulge us for just a minute. You may remember, it was, I think, 1994/1995, one of the first internet, maybe one of the first ever internet conferences out in Dana Point or some such thing. And I think that's where we met for the first time. And it was one of these weird things where you meet somebody for the first time and you instantly fall into a conversation. I think both of us recognized we were kindred spirits in a lot of ways. And that, of course, led to the permission marketing interview in Fast Company, which really, I think, helped so much put Fast Company on the map as well. And it's been just a fun intellectual journey for these last 20 years. So it's great to be able to catch up a bit.
And so I hear you have a new book, which we can talk about.
Yes, that is rumor. But what I'd really love to know is how so much of what you're thinking about and teaching about maps to some of the things I'm exploring in the new book. So let's start. Let me start with the point of the exercise. I mean, one of my key messages to readers is that the goal is no longer to be the best at what lots of other people already do. It's to be the only ones who do what you do. Can you develop a definition of success that allows you to stand for something special in the marketplace or in the world and inspires others to stand with you? Now, I'm guessing that you basically agree with that, but my question is, do you sometimes worry that it's too much to ask, that it's just not how most of us are wired? And how do you try to persuade people to think bigger and aim higher and stop looking around and trying to be marginally better than the crowd and be prepared to really strike out in the world, whether it's a product, a project, starting a company that really stands for something distinctive and speaks to who you are and what you care about as a human being?
Here's the conflict. The conflict is a large number of intelligent people want the prizes. And the prizes they want are the flexible work hours, the respect, the beanbag chairs, the espresso machine, the ability to add huge amounts of value with big insights. But they hesitate to pay the price. And the price is you have to reject the comfort of the industrial mindset.
Mm-hmm.
The industrial mindset is, will this be on the test? I met spec. I did what I was told. that is a very seductive offer, and we bought it for 100 years. That offer of compliance in exchange for sort of a good salary is the one our parents had no choice but to accept. But now there's this schism, and some people are getting the prizes because they are willing to fly without that net. But you can't have it both ways. And I'm never sugarcoating the idea that this is easy. It's not easy. It's scary. But lots of things aren't easy. Digging ditches isn't easy either. It's just a different kind of hard. And I know that people are capable of it, but I also know it's wicked scary.
How do you, in your conversations, in your speaking, in your advice that you give, how do you help people make that leap? What is, I don't know if it's a rational thing or it's ultimately a matter of a belief system, but how much of it is trying to explain to people that the industrial mindset, you know, it doesn't provide the security it used to anyway. So why not sort of be willing to make the, or there's got to be something more profound than that. I mean, it is, I think ultimately what I try to do so much in what I write and my speaking is to sort of come on in, the water's fine, encourage people to be prepared to step out of that kind of lockstep way of going through life. I'm not sure I've ever tumbled on the magic set of arguments or just the right buttons to push or what have you, but how do you personally, when you interact with folks, kind of try to nudge people along to get them more comfortable with that take on the world?
Well, this was part of the lesson of the many lessons that I learned from you and Alan, which is that the brilliance of Fast Company was that you understood that if one out of every, 100,000, 300,000 people was into what you were doing, it was enough.
Mm-hmm.
And the water's not fine. And if you read everything from, you know, the D. Hock piece all the way through the first bunch of years of Fast Company, at no point did the article say, this is easy, anyone can do it. What the article said was, people like us do things like this. So my entire thesis is the opposite of the thesis of people on reality TV, the thesis of people who want to reach the masses. My thesis, which lines up, I think, with Lewis Hyde and with Liz Gilbert and with other people who are saying, guess what? The water's not fine. It's actually really cold. But do you really have a choice? Because if you're the kind of person who thinks you have no choice, then I have something to share with you. And what I have to share with you is there's another path available.
Mm-hmm.
And that path gets us back to what it really is to be human. It gets us back to the first principles of why we went to work in the first place. And if that is something you cannot resist, let me show you what that fear feels like. And I will not teach you how to make the fear go away, because you cannot make it go away. But what I can help you understand is that you can dance with it. And one of the stories I like to tell at the end of my talk is I show an image of Gene Kelly and the epic scene in Singing in the Rain, where he's singing out his heart in a rainstorm. And what you notice when I put up the photo is that he's holding an umbrella, a furled umbrella, and that he had an umbrella the whole time. But it's not called singing with an umbrella. It's called singing in the rain, and the rain is the point. And so I think it's a mistake for people to think they can have it both ways. And I have spent the last 10 years passionately arguing that for people who are willing to have it one way, they are capable of getting there.
That's great. You know, I want to just dive into this just a bit more, and I'm going to abandon my list of scripted questions already. But, you know, you're touching on something that I think about a lot, which is the power of hope versus fear. And we're having this conversation in the middle of the presidential election. That's kind of what the public discourse seems to be about right now. But I see it inside organizations too. There are people who get, and organizations that get genuinely excited and energized, knowing it's hard, about the thrill of creation and experimentation and trying to do something that you know, one way or another hasn't quite been done that way before. And then there are others who are at least willing to consider some of this mindset based on the absolute recognition and fear that the world around them is either cratering or has the prospect of cratering. And what is your sense of which is the more, in terms of what makes the human animal tick and also what makes organizational change tick, which is the more powerful motivator, or what's the right blend of hope and fear to keep things moving forward?
Well, there are two parts to your question that I might split apart. One part is, I hate to break this to people, in just a few billion years, the sun is going to burn out and everything will be gone. Now, you can spend a lot of time thinking about that and the nihilism that goes with it, or you can realize that it's 76 degrees on Martha's Vineyard today and that you could go to the beach with your kids. And the choice is, what's fuel? What is going to be fuel for you to do work that you are proud of? Now, sometimes we need fear as fuel, that we need to know that we have an opportunity to do something about global warming right away to get us to do uncomfortable work. But often we need hope, because believing that something is possible makes it way more likely that we will do unreasonable things to accomplish our goals. The second half of your question, though, is what do we do if the boss won't let us?
Mm-hmm.
And there are two routes here as well. The first one is this. Most of the time that people say the boss won't let me, what they're actually saying is, I went to her and said, I want to do something cool, and if it doesn't work, you'll get the blame, but if it does work, I get the credit. Is that okay? And why would she say yes to that? They never do, for good reason. That the way we actually make change in organizations is by taking responsibility, not by seeking authority. And that the people who cause change to happen from the middle, the archetypal fast company change agent, these are people who take responsibility every day, but don't ask for authority before they start. Now, if you work for an organization that has already committed itself in its mind to being doomed, you ought to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And to not leave is to sacrifice your art. And what happens to these organizations is the most passionate people always leave first.
Yeah, yeah.
And then sometimes they get the message and they change their mindset, and sometimes they don't. But I get the fact that we need people to be switchboard operators, but it doesn't have to be you. And that's a choice.
You know, let me, one last kind of personal thing on this about you, and I guess I'm just asking you to wrestle with something I wrestle with a lot, which is, you know, I visit the companies and sort of social change organizations I read about in this new book, for example, and I'm totally over the moon, so excited about what people are doing and they're achieving and, you know, what's driving them and so on. And then, you know, you pick up the front page of the Wall Street Journal, or from time to time you go in and visit with an organization or give a talk, and folks are so joyless and so adrift, you kind of just sort of wonder, you just kind of want to go back to sleep. There's a great quote I cite in the book from the wonderful leadership scholar, John Gardner, who says, quote, "The future is not shaped by people who don't really believe in the future. It's created by highly motivated people, by enthusiasts, by men and women who want something very much or believe something very much." And he calls their outlook on life tough-minded optimism, quote unquote. Now, I got to say, you've always struck me as one of the most positive, optimistic people around. And yet I'm sure when you are, you know, looking at the reception in your books or you meet people, you must get disappointed from time to time about why can't folks get with the program faster? Why does this seem so darn hard? How do you, as someone who seems to have an infinite fuel supply, I don't know, but how do you maintain your own sense of tough-minded optimism in a world which is full of so much bad behavior and so much disappointment and so much just utter mediocrity wherever we look?
I start with this. I have an obligation now, not just an opportunity, to speak up because I've been given leverage. And what that means in an industrial setting is when management has taken away all degrees of freedom from a caring individual and forced them not to care, I need to write about that. I need to speak about that. I need to chip away at it. Even though I can't fix it, maybe I can help a little bit. But the other thing that's going on, which I learned from my teacher and friend Zig Ziglar, he and I did a gig together just once. And backstage, I said to him, Zig, when I'm giving a talk and there's that guy in the third row who won't make eye contact, who's asleep, who's not buying into it, he's literally asleep, I find myself up there aiming my message at him, wake up, wake up. I'm focusing on him. And it's frustrating because it's not getting me anywhere. And Zig turned to me and he said, you know, that guy's not there for you. Don't neglect the people who are there for you. And it totally changed my perspective. And, you know, we all know the starfish parable with the grandson and the grandfather. You throw it back and the grandson says, but grandpa, there are all these starfish. You know, what difference does it make that you threw one back? And the grandpa says, well, it matters to this starfish. And so for me, I get way more impact with someone who is enrolled in where we are trying to go together. And seeking enrollment turns out to be the single most important thing you can do. It goes way beyond permission marketing. Seeking enrollment gives you the leverage to teach. And that's why magazines with subscriptions do better than magazines that get handed out on the street corner, because subscribers are enrolled in the journey. So as teachers, as managers, as leaders, what we have to do is seek people who are enrolled in the journey, and if we have to, ignore the rest of them.
And by the way, that strikes me as a pretty good description of what it takes to do something successful in any field of endeavor. You're launching a product, you're running a project, you're ultimately trying to enlist as many allies as you can, and really as a way to maintain your own energy and impact, staying as focused as you can on those people who seem prepared to enroll and ally with you, understanding that if you're trying to do something special, if you're trying to do something distinctive, almost by definition, you're not for everybody. And if you let the doubters and the naysayers and the folks who just don't seem interested, intrigued by what you're doing occupy too much of your mental space, you're probably A, misdiagnosing the problem and limiting your capacity to make progress. Instead, understand this product isn't for everybody. This experience isn't meant to be a hugely mass thing. By trying to do something distinctive, you're trying to create a set of allies who generally want to associate with you, affiliate with you, and help you succeed. So it's a way of not just interacting with an audience, but it's a way of kind of building a constituency for change, whatever particular field you're in. Would you agree with that?
Not only would I agree, but I'm going to up the ante here a lot. And I'm going to say that the people who don't do that are actually hiding. That the people who are seeking the non-believers, the ones who are trying to get 100% compliance before they leap, know they're not going to get it, and therefore they're hiding. They're using this as an opportunity to blame the system for their lack of progress, when in fact, their choice is what led to the lack of progress.
Yeah, that's great. Let me ask you, I don't know what your take is going to be on this, but one of the things that's got me a little concerned of late, because I try to keep a feel for that kind of overall business culture and business conversation, is that this fascination bordering on obsession we now have in the business community about Uber and Facebook and Google and Silicon Valley, and as exciting and as disruptive and as compelling as all that stuff is, I worry that it, to some degree, gives people in more familiar, more traditional, more ordinary, if you will, settings and fields of endeavor, which by definition is most of us, an excuse for inaction. I can't tell you how many times I'll try to persuade people of stuff. Hey, you know, we can't be a passion brand. We're not Starbucks or Nike. We're, you know, we're a little restaurant, or we're a bus company or whatever. Or we can't rethink ways of delivering stuff in our field. We're not, you know, we've been around for 100 years. We're not Facebook. We're not Google, which is why I tried in this book to set as much of my material as I can in pretty traditional, ordinary, you know, parking garage in Miami Beach, fast food joint in Tennessee, WD-40, the lubricant people. I don't know what your take on our current obsession with Silicon, which, you know, is our second obsession with Silicon Valley in the last 20 years, but how do you think about getting folks from quote-unquote old-fashioned, ordinary fields? I'm now speaking more about business executives than individuals, kind of jazzed and excited about trying to unleash that same sense of possibility that's kind of comes naturally in Silicon Valley.
Jim Leff, the guy who started Chowhound, had a blog post a year or two ago. He paid all the bills for years and years as a professional trombonist. And he said that almost all the jazz musicians he had gigged with over the years didn't really like jazz that much, weren't that creative, and were just doing their job. So when we think about jazz and we think about John Coltrane or Christian McBride, these people are the exceptions. Mm-hmm. When we think about Silicon Valley, almost everybody in Silicon Valley is insanely conservative, unwilling to take any reasonable kinds of risks, and just holding on for dear life till their stock options vest. That, you know, I worked at the late lamented Yahoo after mm-hmm. they bought my company, and I rarely talked about it in public. But most of the people who were there in 99, 2000, were like, cool it, quiet down, let's just let this thing unfold because it's working. And so it's a mistake to believe that those other people are filled with mm-hmm. visionaries who are, you know, the real innovators at Uber are the drivers who game the system every day to find a tiny advantage and yeah. are using competitive game theory thinking even though they never went to college. And almost everybody else is just there for the ride. So you correctly, Bill, are pointing out that the real insights come from people who care and who care enough to learn the lessons of this new economy without being distracted by scale.
Mm-hmm.
And the lesson of the economy starts with this. You don't change by changing everything. You don't change by having a top-down edict from the CEO. You start with lunch. You start with lunch by inviting three people from three different departments to have lunch with you once a week, where there's a set of rules and where you brainstorm in a whole different way. Or you start with coffee by bringing in stuff during the usual coffee break that's fundamentally different and causes people to transact differently. Or you change the Friday afternoon beer bash into one where you all go to a local elementary school and teach some kid how to do something that she didn't have access to on a cell phone. Right? That these small changes in the real world, looking people in the eye, mm-hmm. these are the things that are actually difficult. That once you do it in the small, making it into the big isn't that hard.
Yep.
It's finding the guts to say, I made this. And this is what industry has boiled out of us. That industry doesn't like it when people say, here, I made this. And it's that shift that you don't need any permission to make. It's that shift that will fill you with anxiety, but it's that shift that your book is going to deliver to people.
Let me ask you to riff just a bit more on that in the following way. I like everybody else, I subscribe to your blog, and I was sort of going through this morning doing a list of your greatest hits over the last 6 months ago. And I one post that jumped out at me, and it relates to this now in a more personal way rather than a corporate change way, was called Managing the Gap. And it really speaks to exactly what we're talking about. You say there's a space between where you are now and where you want to be, ought to be, are capable of being a gap between your reality and your possibility. And then you go on to say, you know, if you think of that space as just so gigantic, you're going to be completely paralyzed. If you ignore it, you're kind of irrelevant. So the idea is to find a path where you can see the immediate steps in front of you, kind of deal. And I found it very moving, because I another issue I see, and I don't know if I help people wrestle with it or not, but there are people in the world who understand that where they are versus as they let their imagination run free, where they hope to be someday are two very different places. And they honestly can't come to terms with how you get from point A to point B. And can you just say a bit more? Maybe this is in a more personal sense, in terms of folks trying to make sense of the world, this idea of managing the gap for those of us who see the gap, as opposed to those who want to be blind to it, but genuinely have questions about, okay, how do I start this journey?
The way Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile wasn't by breaking the 4-minute mile. He and his coach divided the mile into many, many, many small little sections and knew how many seconds he needed to run each section in, how long each stride needed to be. And if you just ticked off all those things, you were going to run a 4-minute mile. It was impossible that you would fail if you could do each one of the little sections. So when we think about how is it that somebody transforms a brand or gets a startup underway or gets a new B2B client, in their head, it's super easy to say, oh, I see that guy over there. I love the fact that he has a book of businesses, $6 million a year. I love the fact that he gets to take the breaks he takes, or he gets the respect he gets, whatever. But where we stumble is we don't say, step one's got to be, I need to be the person who, when I call a person like X, they take my call. Okay, well, what does that require? And then what does that require? And then what does that require? And we work our way all the way back. And the only way we can do that is if we accept that we are going to regularly fail in small ways.
Mm-hmm.
That the act of failing in small ways on a regular basis is the only way we get better. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the conceit and the horrible mythology of the famous college. Because the famous college says to impressionable 17-year-olds, put $250,000 up, we'll put you in this institution where you will not fail, and then at the end you'll have this degree and magically you'll be a different person. Well, because they haven't had any failures for 4 years, now all they've got is debt. Whereas somebody who spends 4 years repeatedly failing as they learn, leveling up, understanding that failure isn't fatal, walks out 4 years later, whether they've gone to college or not, with a posture that says, why not? And that posture is where innovation comes from.
That's great. I want to take that, what you just said, and spin it a slightly different way. In the book, one of the phenomenon I wrestle with, and now we're back to, I think, making change in existing organizations or individuals trying to move and morph with what's going on in the world, is what this innovation strategist at Intel calls the paradox of expertise, which she has seen often among technical people. She looks, but I think it applies to everybody, is the longer you've been part of a field, the better at it you've got, the more successful you become. Oddly enough, oftentimes it becomes harder and harder to see new ways to solve problems, to make sense of new opportunities. We live in a world where as important as experience and mastery is, oftentimes what we know can limit what we can imagine. And so the question sort of becomes, you know, every day you look in the mirror, am I learning as fast as the world is changing? Am I making sure that all the stuff that has served me so well up to this point professionally or in our company isn't holding me back, even unintentionally, from seeing a whole new set of possibilities? Now, we can talk about that strategically, but, you know, I have to say, as I watch you from afar, I just always admire your capacity to take what is a point of view about the world, a body of work, a set of canons, if you will. But you're always, I think, finding new ways to share them, express them, package them, move them around. Do you have a set of habits in your own life, things you are asking yourself to make sure that you keep learning? Because I got to say, this is what sort of, I mean, nothing much keeps me up at night. I'm getting old enough, so I just kind of fall asleep. But as I worry about sort of my own ongoing journey, I just see what's going on. And I say, my goodness, as a person who cares about this set of this body of material and these ideas, am I in fact pushing myself to keep learning as fast as, or it's just so easy to get satisfied? And you just seem like an insatiably curious person. I'm just wondering, how do you think about your own journey? How do you conduct yourself to push yourself to keep learning and moving and changing and being willing to question what's worked for you so far?
Well, it's a secret, but I'll tell you if you promise not to tell anyone else. Issue 31, 1999, you can look it up. I need to use very direct language because you're using sugarcoating language to hide people from the fear. I think direct language is more helpful here.
Mm-hmm.
It's about incompetence. Competent people don't like the feeling of being incompetent.
Yes, sure.
But all innovation is being incompetent on your way to doing something that's never been done before. So my discipline, if I have one, is to set myself up into situations in which I will be, at least for a while, incompetent. And that is the secret to learning. The problem we have in an industrial economy is we don't reward people enough for incompetence. We over-reward them for competence. And competent people make great cogs in the machine, but they're not the people we want to turn to when the world changes.
I am going to take that to heart. I think that's a fabulous way. And I've written back down issue 31, 1990. What article are you talking about? Do you remember?
I wrote a column called In the Face of Change, the Competent Are Helpless.
Oh my goodness.
And I talked about the guy we hired to fix up our house. And the problem was that he was a competent contractor. And as a result, he was trapped. And as the world changed, he completely fell apart.
Oh my goodness. I'm going to go reread. I pride myself in having a somewhat photographic memory of the contents of Fast Company.
Well, so which is quite an achievement. It was actually, it went on the web at the end of 99, but it's a January, February 2000 issue, which if I recall was one of the thickest issues any magazine ever published ever.
I think we marketed it as a doorstop when people wanted to stop reading the magazine. Absolutely. So I don't want to keep it for too much longer. Let me just ask you a couple of other quick things that are kind of gnawing away.
Sure.
One is, and this is another one of your greatest hits, but one of the things I've started wrestling with and I write about the book is that in a world that in so many ways is being, and this is, by the way, another kind of riff on the business culture right now, in a world that in so many ways is being reshaped by technology, what I see people being hungrier and hungrier for is a greater sense of shared humanity, small gestures, little signals that send some really big messages about who we are and what we care about. And you wrote, I don't know, maybe it was a month or two ago, but you wrote just about this on your blog, and you said, you know, some people go through today unaware that every action they pursue has more than its obvious intent. Asking for a check in a restaurant can be like a standing ovation or put down. You know, you think you're typing an email or making small talk, but, you know, you're also really, and I got to say, it is the rare individual, I think, and also the rare organization that, and it's not being manipulative in any way, it's just being more thoughtful and more, I think, authentic about understanding how humans make sense of one another. And so one of the messages I'm trying to send with the book is we're all into disruptive technology and new business models, but we also have an opportunity to go back and think about reconnecting, expressing ourselves, often in even the smallest ways, in ways that just communicate to our colleagues, to our customers, to the world at large. We are real human beings communicating with other real human beings about things that human beings care about. And it just feels like we're at an age now where this is an opportunity to rediscover some of that stuff. Would you agree with that?
Well, the question is, can we handle what comes with that?
Yeah.
So if we think about the term Sawubona, which you might hear if you visited Africa, it means I see you. I see you for you, who you actually are. I see that you are a human. And if you use it as a marketing tool, you will debase yourself mm-hmm. and everyone else, because you can't see someone one day and then secretly change the terms and conditions in your contract and rip them off the next day. Because what are they, right? Are they merely pawns in your corporate system, in which case you're not really seeing them? Or are they humans that you care about? The problem is it doesn't scale. And I'm totally okay with that, totally. I would rather spend the rest of my career at a smaller scale, which is what I've chosen to do. I am not seeking new readers. Mm-hmm. I'm not seeking to find people who haven't heard of me who will now turn around and become whatever they are. I am trying to see the people who have already seen me and be able to engage with them at the most human scale I'm capable of. But that comes at a cost. And so when you think about how some of the beloved brands, once they go public, once they get giant, change, the way they change is they stop seeing their customers and they start seeing their shareholders instead.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is, the good news is, and I write about a few of these case studies in the book, there are still the reorganizations, USAA comes to mind. That
sure.
When, and in part because of the very unique mission of the company, which is to serve active and retired members of the military and their family, but they work so hard about, you know, culture is a kind of a crummy word, but creating a sense of peer-to-peer commitments among all 18,000 people there. This is what you have signed up for. This is what it means to be a member of this organization. Every once in a while, we're all going to have lunch and eat, you know, meals ready to eat, MREs, the stuff we eat. Every once in a while, we're going to walk around for a couple of hours wearing, you know, 65-pound backpacks or Kevlar vests to remind our, it is kind of the I see you thing, that these our customers are not, you know, cells in an Excel spreadsheet, or these are real live human beings, many of them military people in the field, many of them who did amazing things for the country. And we are, even though we're 18,000 of us, and we're interacting with them on the phone or over, you know, internet chat, we have no face-to-face communication, we are going to, and it's just, you know, every time I mention USA in the talk or whatever, people come up after saying it's, you know, I'm a member, it's the most amazing company I've ever encountered. And they are few and far between, to be sure. But the good news is if organizations, you know, let alone individuals, if organizations say to themselves, we have to understand that if we want to be special and human in the marketplace, we've also got to be special and human in the workplace and understand the commitments we're making to one another, and then see how those commitments translate.
Exactly.
You know.
And there will be, there are meetings about compromise at places like that where all forces are aligned to compromise. But somebody has the guts to let the image and the soul of the customer into the room. And in those tough moments, they say, we're not giving up what we stand for. And organizations over time lose that ability. That's why there are so few truly great organizations.
Yeah.
Because when the pressures line up, they say, oh yeah, we'll just update the software, even though it's going to really mess with people. It's better for us.
Yeah.
And that's the fight you've been fighting since the day I met you and that I've been fighting, which is the whole point of everything we do is not to make more stuff. We have enough stuff. The point of everything we do is to make it worth it. And what it means to do stuff that's worth it is to do things that matter, to do things that might not work, to do things that connect us, to be missed if we were gone. And I just applaud the new book because it's one more brick in that wall, and it's what we need to hear.
Well, thank you. I think we should end on that very upbeat and uplifting note. I really do. I appreciate it so much, Seth. It's so good to hear the sound of your voice. I learned so much from this conversation. I hope we can see each other soon.
Cheers. Have fun.
Thanks, Seth.
Bye-bye. Bye.